Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Yes, hello out there, everyone, and welcome to the fifth season of None But the Brave. It's just incredible to us. Thank you all for listening. We're presented by Evergreen Podcasts. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy, Flynn McClain. So, Flynn, the Philly shows were unfortunately postponed, but it sounds like Bruce is doing better, and they've now confirmed the tour will resume Thursday in Foxborough.
Yeah, that was great to hear. I'm glad Bruce has recovered, and they're ready to get back out there. Now we're just waiting on the new date for Philly, which hopefully we'll have soon.
Now, one of the other things that everyone is waiting to hear, we expect there's going to be a fall release. There's been a lot of talk about Only the Strong Survive 2. There's been talk, of course, about Tracks 2. Bruce is actually responsible for all of that because he talked to Rolling Stone. He talked to a couple of other sources. Have we heard anything about where it might be headed?
No, just a lot of conflicting reports. One said Volume 2 wasn't coming. The Soul Covers Volume 2 wasn't coming. And then someone said, oh, it still might be. So I really have nothing is clear at the moment. And hopefully things will crystallize sometime soon, at least in the rumors. It's almost been exactly 1 year since first word of Only the Strong Survive League. So
yes.
I mean, any day now, right? We'll hear something.
Well, we'll come back to that. And just for me, my personal opinion, I really hope they don't release Only the Strong Survive 2. We gave the first one a real chance. I think you and I were higher on it than some other people, but it just didn't go over well with the fan base. I don't think it sold well. At this point, I think move on to something else, especially since the never-ending wait for Tracks 2 continues. It seems like hopefully it's going to be time for that now. And Sony can't be in favor of Only the Strong Survive 2, I would think, because, again, it didn't sell well. They just paid for his catalog. It's all covers. It can't be thrilling for them.
Yeah, there's no publishing there for them either. And, yeah, I'm with you. I got to admit, Soul Covers Volume 2 would be a disappointment. Last year I listened to it a bit, that lead copy we got, and then once it came out officially, I was like, kind of over it, and went back to the Nugs releases in terms of what Bruce listening I was doing. And Tracks 2 would go a long way toward getting me excited about what's going on. That is for sure.
Yeah, and if Tracks 2 comes out, we're going to go full force on that. So,
to say the least, gosh, you know, fifth year's the charm, right, Hal? We've been hearing about this since spring of 19.
I hope so. All right, so let's set up what we're going to be doing now, because obviously the tour is on a break, and also, as everyone is fully aware, the set lists have been very static. We're going to move off of talking about tour 2023 for the moment, and we're going to do one of our usual subjects, which is something that people have asked us about because they're surprised we haven't done it yet, and that is our look at the rising tours. That's where we're going to start tonight. We're going to go back to the beginning of the tour, the rehearsals and everything that happened from there. And then we'll see how long it runs and where we are. We're going to break at some point, and then we'll come back and do more in the next episode.
Yeah, it's funny. Just one of these topics I swore we did, but I guess we had not. And it's one that we've got numerous requests for, and it's something we enjoy talking about. That is for sure. I remember after the reunion tour, a lot of speculation about, was that it? Or is he going to go back and make some new music with the Easter Band? And Fortunately, he did make some new music with the band, got the Rising, first outside producer ever. They went outside their little usual production crew, and they delivered the Rising, which we've done a track-by-track analysis of.
Yes.
And of course, the tour, the live tour is where it's at. So let's start in Asbury Park, Al.
Yes, and it was a magnificent tour overall, and not to take shots at Tour 2023, but we're going to get a real juxtaposition about what he used to do artistically with these shows, especially at the start of a tour behind a new album, as compared to where we are right now. But you are correct. We started in Asbury, and the album was not out yet. I should correct myself. The album was not even out. He first set up in Fort Monmouth, and then they moved into Convention Hall. And on July 25th, right? They did a short warm-up. It was about half the show for a very select audience.
Yeah, I think it was all Sony employees, if memory serves. But going by the basis of what Convention Hall is, very thin walls sitting on the beach, there were a lot of fans outside listening. And what I remember most was getting the set list almost in real time, almost like today. And I kept getting more and more excited as we saw the show kind of develop. And I'm like, oh man, I can't help myself. I'm going up tomorrow. And so so on July 26th, the next day, I actually did drive up, took off from work and said, even if I'm just outside listening, I'm going for it here. And that's what I did.
I forget. Did you get into that show?
I did.
Right.
That show. Yeah, I didn't see you until afterwards, but yeah, I got in, went up with my friend Kathy living in DC at the time, and I think we got in about 3/4 of the way through the Rising, through the opening song, and I was like, oh my god, I can't believe we're here, and then it was amazing. I gotta admit there, and seeing Lonesome Day for the first time after hearing the leaked copy for a few weeks, it hit good. Prove it. It was great. I remember the guy next to me actually said, oh, the new stuff's good, but it's all about the old stuff. And I was almost the direct opposite. At that point, I was so excited about the new album.
Well, July 26, 2002, this was the first official rehearsal show, played to the entire building, not just a very small select number of people like the day before. And this was a special day. The album was not out yet. Now, in full disclosure, I had heard it. Had you heard it?
How? I sent it to you.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Let's get that straight. I sent it to you. And yeah, we had it a few weeks earlier.
Well, and a lot of people had heard it because people were very familiar with the new material, which would become part of the story. We'll get to Mary's Place in a moment. But the show opened. It was very powerful. The show that he put together, and of course, this was 9 months, 10 months after 9/11 had occurred, and it really spoke to the times, to the location, and I thought the show he put together at the very start of the tour, as you noted, opened with The Rising, Lonesome Day, and then Prove It All Night, and The Fuse, which is such an underplayed song, and I thought live, it was just tremendous. What did you think?
Oh, I loved it. I thought it had extra powers. I mean, I can see where the album version might have been a little bit too restrained, but in a live setting with the crowd there, especially the response to the Bittersweet Taste on My Tongue line, it was pretty powerful. I'd admit that. What I thought was interesting was that it was more or less modeled on the reunion tour set list. There were 5 rockers to start the show. Then a couple of purely acoustic song, Empty Sky, and then You're Missing. And then it kind of went back to Because You're Missing So Intense and went to Sunny Day and Promised Land. But then I felt like Worlds Apart through Mary's Place was basically the 5-pack 2002 version. I think Worlds Apart basically acted as both Youngstown and Murder Incorporated. And then there were some nights, I think, before too long, Badlands appeared after Worlds Apart, and so that kind of comparison really cemented itself.
Totally agree. And on this first night, he actually did 10th Avenue, which really made that point clearer. He ultimately lost 10th Avenue because, quite honestly, Mary's Place and 10th Avenue back-to-back there was sort of hitting the same note.
My memory of 10th Avenue is that when he didn't stop it after after the bridge and go into the big spiel when he just went straight into the big man joined the band line. My friend Kathy and I, we like high five. We're like, thank goodness. We're ready for that song to be more in its original compact arrangement.
Well, Mary's Place, as I was saying a couple of minutes ago, I think was the fan favorite at that moment. And Bruce was very surprised when people were singing the lines back to him in Mary's Place, a song that hadn't been officially released yet. He was like, oh, wait, you guys have heard it?
I thought that happened on Sunny Day as well.
Maybe it did. I specifically remember on Mary's Place.
Okay. I got to be honest. My memories of that day are a little bit hazy at this point, but there were some things I do remember, like I said, at 10th Avenue and the Fuse and the guys next to me during Prove It. I remember walking on air coming out of that show. I thought it was, I was so excited.
It was definitely one of the best rehearsal shows we've seen. There was just a feeling about it that was different than some of the other shows. I think of even like 2009, the Working on a Dream shows. Well, those shows, there were a couple of rehearsal shows later on where the show didn't work very well, which he knew. And then he would alter the show. This show worked from the start. Well, it worked until they got to the Meadowlands, but that's jumping ahead a bit. But it worked fully as a set list and as a narrative. And I think just as a concert, whatever the problems that we're going to discuss come opening night at the Meadowlands. But here it was phenomenal.
Well, the problems at the Meadowlands had nothing to do with the set list in and of itself. Let's not kid ourselves there. But yeah, he did bring out quite the set list that stuck around. I think that was the set for the entirety of the tour. And maybe it was because he modeled it so much on the reunion set and the fact that he relied on so many new songs, and they were excellent new songs. I love The Rising. I'm pretty sure you do too. Mm-hmm. And he was able to really fit things in. The Waiting, the Sunny Day into Promised Land, into Worlds Apart, that worked really, really well. And it just kept going from there.
11 new songs from The Rising plus American Skin. You don't really see a lot of artists do that. And Land of Hope and Dreams. You don't see a lot of artists do that. Certainly, as we know, Bruce is not doing it anymore. And It was very compelling.
As we'll talk about, it was the set that he really didn't change very much at all through the first month of the tour. I mean, I'm just talking about wild cards and songs being rotated in or out. But the backbone of the set was here, and it worked really well. And I'm surprised you call that a really good rehearsal show, because I thought the one on the 30th was even better.
Well, we're gonna get to that. I thought all of the Rising rehearsal shows in general were superb and probably the best ones that have taken place. I think back to Magic and Working on a Dream. They certainly were nowhere near as good as these. This had a significantly different feel from the reunion shows because, of course, there was this stellar new album that we had already all heard. And I think people wanted to hear the new material, right?
Absolutely. That's what I was there for, and I wanted to hear what would be the set closer and what was going to be the big band intro number. Those are the things that I wanted to know. Those were my questions as I walked in, and certainly how great some of the stuff really sounded. I love Sunny Day on the album. I still do. And so it was interesting to hear what he did with it then, and Worlds Apart as well. That was one of my faves on the album, and it's kind of faded over time, but I was really excited to hear it live.
So that was Friday, July 26th. We came back to Asbury on July 30th. Truly one of the crazier days of my life, at least in terms of seeing concerts, because it started, I met your wife, it must have been at like 5 a.m. I know we had to be in the venue, I think by, it was like 6 or 6:30. And I, of course, was still a little bit on L.A. time. And I was so tired that morning when we entered Convention Hall. Who would have ever thought they were going to be in Convention Hall at that hour? And wow, that was a wild day.
I didn't get into the morning show, so you'll have to pick up on that. Obviously, I've seen it, but you'll have to talk about the experience of being inside the building and not outside.
It was a lot of fun. I was in the bathroom splashing water on my face when I heard Bruce on stage tuning his guitar, saying that he was going to come out and warm us up. And then the next thing I knew, Does This Bus Stop was being played. I ran back out and to Claudine. And then he did For You and a very nice version of Waiting on a Sunny Day, where Nils, Patty, Gary, and Clarence all came out. And then he said he was going to go back and get ready. He also made several references to it not being a rock and roll hour for him. And then they went live on the Today Show and introduced the Rising material to the world. And it may have been very early for them, but they were on the Rising, Lonesome Day, Glory Days, and especially Into the Fire. I thought it was just great. And I think the public really embraced the record. And as we know, it opened at number one.
Yes, I thought it was he chose the right songs to introduce the album and introduce the tour to fans nationwide. Certainly opening with The Rising into Lonesome Day. That said, that was the thesis statement for the tour, basically. And Glory Days, basically, it hadn't been played at all on the reunion tour. So I guess he had gotten far away enough from his mindset in 99-2000 of, I'm not going to play the hit singles from Born in the USA. I'm just going to stick with the album tracks. But he brought Glory Days back, and it was fun. I got my PJs under my, or got my pajamas underneath my clothes. I think that was the line. And then, of course, Into the Fire just hit home for everybody who saw what happened on 9/11. And here was an excellent song about it. And on national television, it was, I don't want to call it a national healing moment, but maybe for some of us it was.
We neglected to point out that at the July 26th show, there was a bagpipes intro played by Clarence to Into the Fire. That was not done on the Today Show, but that's going to become highly relevant now as we head into the afternoon of July 30th, a blazing hot day. We were online in that field. I remember I bought ice packs and I had them on my neck. It must have been like 100 degrees and it was broiling.
It was freaking hot. That is for sure. And there was, and it wasn't even announced. It was just kind of like known.
$20 at the door.
What?
$20 at the door.
Yeah. And it just seemed like it wasn't announced. And I kept calling it the great Bruce Mines rhymes with stuck. And because he had announced it, yet here we all are. We had no idea what it would take to get in. And there were some rumors that if you went to some local shops in Asbury and bought something and showed your receipt, you would get preference to getting in. It was very weird that day. I escaped the heat by hanging out in the lobby of the Berkeley. So I was okay with that, but it was all worth it for the show. It was even better than 4 days prior.
It was. This probably was the best of the rehearsal shows played at Convention Hall. The show opened again with Rising and Lonesome Day, and then in the third slot, which hadn't been played in 10 years at that point, well, 9 years, I guess, since 93, Cover Me in a compact version without the intro and outro. And the minute it started and the way they played it, my hair stood up on my neck. It was like, yes, this is the song. This is rock and roll. And it was tremendous.
I kind of lost my shit. I got to admit there when he went into that, because I thought a compact, as you said, tight version of that one was overdue to be played. And he did it and it worked quite well. It was interesting because at the first couple of rehearsal shows, he did Prove It. And then at this one, he did Cover Me. And at the subsequent one, he did Jackson Cage. So I guess he was trying out different songs in that slot. But he finally settled on Prove It for the rest of that month, or the month of August anyway.
Yeah, it was followed by The Fuse and Darkness. It was really a good run of songs with Cover Me in there, and it was surprising that he didn't use it more often after that. But then midway through the show, after Mary's Place, he did My Hometown, and then in a moment that, again, should have been repeated more often, although taking a lot of concentration from the audience, they premiered Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And how brilliant was that?
Very. Yeah, that was disappointment that it didn't didn't get played that much at all that year. I think it was played, what, once or twice on the whole tour even. But it was such a beautiful arrangement, and it really hit home, I mean, especially at that time, talking about the last verse, talking about the what was basically a 9/11 widow. And the timing and the effect was great. It was, like I said, a disappointment. It wasn't played more often.
Listen to this run of songs: Paradise, Counting on a Miracle, then American Skin. Now, we talk about narratives. That's a compelling one. And then they were going to do Into the Fire. This is where the bagpipes come into play. Clarence had some issues with the bagpipes. I think he took out a mic stand with them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The bagpipes were such an unwieldy instrument. And he just, knocked over a mic stand and just didn't quite work.
And that was the end of the bagpipes. Bruce was like, get rid of those things. And they were never seen again on an E Street Band stage. And interestingly, he audibled to Born in the USA right there after American Skin because he wanted a moment to collect himself or for everyone to get settled with Into the Fire. And they did Born in the USA, and then they did Into the Fire. That was really a colossal moment as far as him putting together a run of songs. And, you know, this is what he was doing back then. He wanted to use the new material, as we've talked about many times, to augment the older material and have the pieces fit together. And really, here he was doing it about as well as he's ever done it. Hi, I'm Hal Schwartz from None But The Brave, and I want to tell you about our exciting new sponsor, DistroKid. DistroKid is a service for musicians that puts your music into online stores and streaming services like Spotify. You keep 100% of your royalties. The DistroKid app is packed with features. You can check your streaming stats from Apple and Spotify, upload lyrics and song credits. You can also get notified via push notifications when you've earned royalties. With Mixia, a powerful tool for those without access to professional mastering engineers, users can put the finishing touches on their track in minutes. There's a simple interface that is easy to use even if you're a novice creator. It's only $99 for a year with unlimited mastered tracks. DistroKid also has a new feature called Instant Share that allows you to easily share large files securely. Send tracks to collaborators, booking agents, and anyone else you want to hear your work. Your music will stream at the highest quality so you can make a great impression. And the artwork files look great too. So check out DistroKid through None But The Brave special link and receive 30% off your first year. DistroKid.com/VIP/MBTB. Once again, DistroKid.com/VIP/MBTB. Thank you.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask? Good
morning. I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
So I have 2 comments about this post Mary's Place part of the show. And first one is that there were 6 songs done in that segment from my hometown through Into the Fire. And he never did that many songs at a regular tour show. Even if Born in the USA was going to be played in the encore, but was audible to the second set of the main set, still 5 songs would be a lot. And the second thing is, yeah, you're counting on a miracle as being part of the narrative. Coming out of Paradise really works well. I hear Miracle as being about losing your touch and your skin and all that. So it's about mourning of a relationship. And Paradise is, you have that last verse, and yeah, that's quite the pairing.
Yeah, and of course, My Hometown came before Paradise, and as we mentioned, American Skin followed Miracle. So I think all of that fit together. After they finished with Into the Fire, He did Thunder Road. He did Glory Days. Now, at this point, because he had broken up the My City of Ruins, Born in USA pairing, My City of Ruins was played, followed by Born to Run, which was the only time that combo was played on the entire tour. And then the show ended with Land of Hope and Dreams and People Get Ready.
Yes. And the encore, I think, it was somewhat shortened anyway. I feel like, but it wasn't. Looking at it, there were going to be six songs, and there were six songs here. But yeah, he was still trying to figure out what he wanted to do with the encore. And certainly USA into Land of Hope and Dreams, which he would eventually settle on, worked pretty damn good.
You would agree this was probably the best of the rehearsal shows we saw at Convention Hall.
Like ever or just in 2002?
Ever.
I'm thinking. Probably, because the ones in 99, as you pointed out, they were a little tentative. They were still getting their legs back under them. And in 2007 and 2009, I think you said he was having trouble finding the show. And this one, he had already found it, and they just needed to hone it in on the performance. But yeah, they were still rehearsal shows, so any mistakes are easily forgiven.
We were back in Asbury again on that Friday, August 2nd. You were not at that show, if I recall.
I was not. I had seen two shows in the previous week. Couldn't really justify going up another one. And turns out it was pretty damn hot, if I remember hearing correctly.
It was. And the show was hot as well. This was, again, an afternoon show, and it was abbreviated. I think they were getting ready to depart the venue. So this show, the encores were abbreviated, and also the main set was abbreviated. But there was a couple of very notable additions. The biggest, you already mentioned, Jackson Cage, which I was, when it started, I couldn't believe it. This was still the phase where we were really being surprised at points, and Jackson Cage was a song I really never expected to hear.
Yeah, I was very surprised to hear that as well, and obviously very excited and hoping that he would make it a regular part of the show, which unfortunately did not happen, at least for the first month and a half. But yeah, that was it was a holy shit moment, I'm sure, for a lot of people, and there were more to come, that is for sure.
The other notable addition to this show was Backstreet's Paradise was played again. I believe that was the last performance of Paradise on the entire tour until that one acoustic version in D.C., right?
I believe you're correct. I'm not able to really look it up at the moment, but it sounds about right. I remember on the compilation I put together from 2002, it was that rehearsal show from July 30th that I used. Now, what I find most notable about this show was that there was no City of Ruins. He did My Hometown, Born to Run, Ramrod, Hope and Dream. So a four-song abbreviated encore, as you said, and it's surprising that My Hometown made it in there instead of City of Ruins.
I think at that point they were sort of working out some material, and my guess is he knew they had My City of Ruins down and they were getting out of the venue and it was going to be a shorter show, so that was why it was skipped.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I remember hearing that might have also been a thunderstorm approaching. Am I misremembering that or confusing that with another show?
That I don't recall, in all honesty.
Okay. All right, well, let's move on to East Rutherford Hall on August 5th.
Yeah, so they
half filled arena.
They moved into the venue and they did a public rehearsal show, which I found very weird. It just seeing a show in a, I think it was more than half empty, it was more like 75% empty, but seeing a show in that kind of venue, they also did not curtain the upper levels, if I remember correctly. So the sound was off because there was so much dead space, but it was a good show. It showed that they were getting ready for opening night, and it was pretty much the set list we would come to expect for the first month.
Now, what's notable to me is that basically in the first, I guess, through Mary's Place, every song except for one were either from The Rising or Darkness on the Edge of Town. Did you ever, what are your thoughts on that one?
Oh, I think it makes total sense that he used a heavy dose of Darkness next to The Rising songs to create this show. The Rising songs, of course, were in many ways based off the event that we had all experienced the year before. But as we've discussed many times, they're also much more universally themed, especially something like You're Missing, which could be about someone waiting for someone to come home on September the 12th, 2001. And it also can be about someone who has suffered a loss, their spouse has died of cancer or some other illness. And then by adding in the darkness songs, I think you bring in that sense of isolation, because darkness is an album where there is a lot of isolation. No,
you are correct. And I always think of the Sunny Day Promised Land combo, which is, I guess, in a lot of ways that's his whole career right there. Everybody's being hopeful, looking for a better day. And then Promised Land is just continues it in a very different manner.
Yeah, I love the Fuse darkness combo. That when you think about the two people searching for a connection in that room, and then you come out and it's really, in a way, very dark, no pun intended, because at the end of the song, as we know, the character has lost the connection. His wife is gone, and he's going to be on that hill fighting for every inch that he can get, but he doesn't have it yet. And I think that's where we get into the next portion of the show with Empty Sky and You're Missing. Is that how you read it?
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Certainly, I think a lot of us were dealing with a darkness, especially people who had lost someone on 9/11. And that's the darkness. It was in a lot of towns, and it was felt by a lot of people. And certainly, Empty Sky continued that. And then You're Missing, which is one of his greatest songs about loss.
And the Waiting on a Sunny Day, I understand, with children on stage and everything that has occurred since, people have become tired of it, including us. But in this context, coming out of darkness, Empty Sky, You're Missing, I mean, it was very literal. We were waiting on a sunny day. And as you point out, then it launched into Promised Land, which is pretty much the entire thesis of his career.
True. And then it goes into that kind of the five pack or a four pack now, but that parallels the one from 99-2000 quite well.
As we're talking about it, I mean, the way that he was capable of constructing a show and the manner in which he stated these things to an audience that, especially in New York, had suffered such a horrible collective experience. It's really quite amazing. I mean, I think sometimes the Rising, the record, doesn't get the full amount of credit it deserves. This is tremendous art right here. And we know he would do it again. I think he did it again on the Magic Tour, which we've discussed. He hasn't done it anywhere near this level as much since then, a little bit in 2012.
Yeah, a little bit. But yeah, I think this was the pinnacle of that, at least in the reunion era. And of course, the question that always comes to mind is, would there have been a 2002 album from Bruce if it hadn't been for 9/11? And certainly the most more impactful songs on the record, The Rising, Lonesome Day, You're Missing, Empty Sky, they were all influenced by that. But then there were others, Sunny Day, and what's the one about Nothing Man? They had already worked on that one. So I wonder what it would have looked like without that awful day.
Yeah, that's a question that's almost impossible to answer. Perhaps we'll get a little insight into it if the recording sessions the band did prior to 9/11 are represented in tracks 2. I think that would be very interesting to hear. Now, that brings us to the first night of the tour, August 7th, 2002. We're going to pick up the pace here a little, especially since the set list is going to remain the same pretty much for the next batch of shows.
Irony. Okay.
But what happened on August 7th, 2002? Because I often cite this as the worst Springsteen show I've ever seen, and I think some others do as well. It was pretty off the rails.
Yeah, there were some sound issues. It didn't seem like they were all quite there. I mean, it's not surprising that Bruce would be a little tentative at the start of a tour, as I said before, especially since there was so much new material coming into the show. But it was a little bit more than just that. I don't know, this seems like, I remember Steve having trouble with his guitar and there were sound issues. It just didn't seem like everything was going there. It was weird because I thought the rehearsal shows that we saw were excellent. And then they come into the first night of the official tour and it's just, they kind of dropped the ball on this one. The whole band, I don't think we can blame any one person.
No, I always thought that perhaps the moment got a little big for them just because of the horrible circumstances and obviously the arena is a few miles from Ground Zero, and they were unveiling this new show, and he had done all this press, and just maybe on that one night, which of course we've really rarely seen, I think maybe they got impacted by the technical problems and they just lost a little bit of their edge, and the show from there just sort of fell apart. It's funny, I'm reading on Brucebase, and I'm quoting, "Not the greatest show to open the tour, with technical and pacing problems." That sums it up very succinctly.
But it's weird that, talking about pacing problems, because this was the set. This was the set that was going to, they had done four or five times already, and they were going to do another 3 weeks worth. So I don't know about if pacing is the right issue. But of course, I remember, wasn't this Bruce's calming piss show right before he came on stage?
That I don't recall. I haven't listened to this show. I probably have never listened to this show again.
It was either here, either at this show or at the Philly show in October. So I have to go back and listen to at least one of those.
As we know, there are no archive releases other than Helsinki from this tour. But this wouldn't have been a choice for the release anyway.
Nothing from August, I think, would even qualify. But because the shows did improve, they found their groove, they found their confidence. And I think from September on, they were on fire. But let's keep talking about August.
Well, very specifically, the tour opened at the Meadowlands. Then they went to Washington, D.C., and then they went to the Garden. That was clearly no accident.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. They hit the spots. I was surprised that D.C. was so early. I was still living there at the time, and it was great to have the hometown show be so early. But at the same time, it was like, well, maybe they should have gotten all their legs under them before they came down. But I saw these first three shows, and I thought everyone got better. Obviously, they had hopefully nowhere to go after that first show at the Meadowlands, but the second show in D.C., addition of Bobby Jean, wasn't thrilled about, but Born in the USA and Atlanta, Hope and Dreams in that particular city, I thought was pretty momentous. And then at the Garden, I think it was a big surprise that he really didn't talk much. I think he said something about, "You guys have been on our minds recently," without continuing on further. But again, it was a better show than DC. And this was one of the first shows where it was from here on. It was, this was the show.
Yeah. And one of the things that was going on here, I think, was because they had the problems opening night and it was a very tightly constructed set. Anyway, early on, you were getting the same set every night, and there were not a lot of complaints. I mean, there was some people going, "When is he going to change the set?" But people understood what was happening. It was different than, say, what's going on in 2023.
Oh, absolutely. He was, half the show was new from just 2 years earlier, and it was a strong album. We were very excited about the album, and we were really getting into hearing them every night. I was already, you know, ready to move on from like The Promised Land or Two Hearts and Bobby Jean. But those songs certainly had their part in this set. And the new stuff, I thought, really, those were the highlights for me.
The songs were amazing. And it's too bad that so many of these songs have never really been played again after this tour. But these early shows, while they were less than perfect, and to be fully honest, as we go through the tour, and if we were talking about archives to release, if they were able to access them, there would be very little from this segment of the tour that we would be talking about in terms of releases, especially the level of the shows just went up basically show by show by show. Then they were flying by the time they got a little bit later in the year.
Yes, that first month they were still trying to get their road legs going because they had the new material and they were integrating into the new show. But as you said, every show got better. They started adding some stuff like Viva Las Vegas came in. I think you were at that Vegas show.
Well, that was interesting because that was a very, very solid performance. And people who we were with who had seen some of the other shows, because I had left after the Meadowlands, the Vegas show was colossally better than the Meadowlands show. And people said that was like the first time they really nailed it. And the Viva Las Vegas was thrown in. I think that may have been an audible. There were definitely some people, I'm not going to name any names, throwing some dice on stage at some point during that show. And, once they nailed the show, he started to loosen up quite a bit.
Yes, he did. And at the next show in Portland on August 20th, Atlantic City made its tour debut, followed by Backstreet's later in the show. It was played at the rehearsal shows earlier, but this was its first tour proper performance. And in Tacoma, August 21st, I think we have literally the biggest tour debut of that tour, and it's one that still resonates today. The rock version of Dancing in the Dark, led by the electric guitar instead of the synthesizers, and the song was totally rejuvenated.
It was so exciting, and
Were you in Tacoma?
I was not in Tacoma, but I would hear it at the next show, which was in LA, and it was just what a burst of energy. Now, of course, Dancing in the Dark had really not been played on the reunion tour. It was played a couple of times in sort of a country swing arrangement, but certainly nothing approaching a rock arrangement. And
actually, really, Hal, it hasn't been played in the rock arrangement or in any kind of full band since 88.
Right, that's right. Because 92, 93 was solo.
Right, that solo electric guitar arrangement. And of course, he never did it on the Joe tour.
What was your reaction when you heard it for the first time? It was like a totally new song.
It was, but we still knew it. It was something new, it was something familiar, and I absolutely loved it. I thought it was, as you said, a burst of energy. It really gave this tour kind of a new personality, its own distinct personality that was very different than the reunion tour. Obviously, I see that he followed it up with Ramrod, which he would do a number of times, which was not exactly a rarity in 2000. But the fact that he brought it hard, it gave it an edge, almost was like an edge to it. And yeah, I loved it. I loved it totally. I mean, I still get into it today. It's just not as special.
I think also the way he used it, because Into the Fire ended the main set as it did at all of these early shows. And then Dancing in the Dark led off the encore. And again, Dancing in the Dark, as we know, is a song about isolation.
And finding connection.
And finding, you're 100% right. It just works so well. And you look back on these days now, I think we probably, at the time, we wouldn't have expected that Dancing in the Dark would pretty much literally be played in that arrangement from that moment on until the end of time, because that kind of thing didn't really happen at Springsteen shows. I mean, Born to Run got played every night. Everything else was pretty much subject to be removed here and there. But it obviously has stuck around until today.
Yeah, I guess Badlands was like one of the main songs, and maybe Promised Land, that had really been in the set almost nightly since this debut in 78. And Dancing in the Dark kind of continued that with 2002 through 2023, as I look at my calendar. And I think it's been a highlight for people or a lot of fans really ever since. Maybe we're a little bit tired of it. Maybe our little repeat goers, we've seen it a lot, but it still gets the people in the upper deck really excited. Not that I'm trying not to be condescending. I'm just trying to say the more casual fans really, really get into it.
And it works really well in 2023. We have to be fully clear about that.
Yes.
The shows I saw in Europe, I thought the encores worked great. The thing about the Dancing in the Dark this year is, whether it was because of the COVID protocols or trying to keep the show a little bit shorter, you don't get a lot of the craziness where there's people on stage for 4 or 5 minutes. So in its compact version, the song is obviously a masterpiece, and it works phenomenally well.
Totally agree. So you were at the next show at the Forum in LA.
I was at the Forum, and then I was at San Jose. And this was, again, he was back to doing sort of the basic set, although now Dancing in the Dark was in there every night with Ramrod. And then
hold on one second. What do you mean back to the basic set? There was nothing not in the basic set, unless you want to say the debut of Dancing.
That's made true. It, right. You're right.
Made it
you're
special
right.
because
well, there was no Atlantic City or Backstreets in those California shows, which well, those were some of the Portland.
Those were some of the first songs that really became rotated, that slot, that darkness slot, and whatever was between Miracle and Into the Fire.
Yes.
Looking at the Inglewood set list, he did Counting on a Miracle, Thunder Road, American Skin, Into the Fire. So that was a little bit different, not doing it in the encore.
You're right. And that's totally true. And let's move on here. There was a show at the Hayden Planetarium, which was tied to the MTV Video Music Awards. I believe your wife attended that show.
Yeah, she did. I remember I had a fantasy football draft that night, so I didn't make the trek up. It was also in the middle of the week, if memory serves. But yeah, it was the MTV Music Awards. I think James Gandolfini was the one who introduced him. And they basically did a mini set of what they were doing. I think it was less than an hour, but it got a nice little soundboard audio release came out of it on the bootleg side, and became one of my favorite listens just because it had the good stuff I wanted to hear.
If I recall properly, also it was a driving video. Rainstorm.
Yes, it was pouring. It was absolutely pouring, and I think Bruce said something about Steve not being a fan of weather because it was raining so much.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
And then the next night, they finished up the first leg of the tour in St. Louis. Again, pretty basic set. Downbound Train was played after The Fuse in Place of Darkness. That's another interesting selection. And then they took a break.
Yeah, I remember at the time we were talking about nobody, there were no artists anywhere that were going to be playing anywhere close to the actual 9/11 date. And so it wasn't a surprise that Bruce basically took a three-week break that covered those first 3 weeks of September before they reunited in Denver for basically the start of the next leg.
Yes, and the 3 weeks, he had been playing pretty much the same basic set for the first month of the tour. That would stop in Denver, and it never happened again.
It never let up.
No, from Denver on, it turned into wild set lists.
But it was still within the overall backbone of,
yes, of course,
of that show of the tour. It's not like,
yes,
all of a sudden he was playing, you know, five songs from Darkness in a row or five songs, you know, without anything from the Rising. It was the non-Rising material that rotated. The third slot, which was often Prove It, was now Ties It Bind in Denver. The fifth slot, which was you just talked about, was Darkness, and it was Downbound. Now it was Candy's Room. And then the spot I talked about earlier between Counting on a Miracle and Into the Fire, Racing in the Street made its tour debut in Denver. And then they also got a debut in the encore of I'm a Rocker. So he was shaking it up. And then you want to talk about the next night in Kansas City or the next show?
I do. But before that, I want to make one point about what you're saying about the slots. This demonstrates so much about what we've been talking about this year, where Bruce would have a foundation of a show that wouldn't change much. The Rising and Lonesome Day, you knew were going to be the openers. But within that, he had sections of the show where he had similarly themed material that he felt he could change, and he did change from night to night. And it made the show that much more compelling, in my opinion.
Well, it became like, what you going to play in this slot, or what you going to play in that slot? So you got to the end of, say, Lonesome Day, and you know, so you find yourself racing, is it going to be Prove It, Jackson Cage, Ties It Bind, Night, all these songs that could be played. So there really was a big mystery about what was going to be happening.
And it's really interesting on this tour how quickly it happened, because he did have the break, but it was basically like he turned on a dime. He went from saying, okay, I've got this set, I really like it, I'm going to do it every night. And then suddenly he was like, okay, I'm keeping the foundation of that, of course, but now let's go freewheeling.
Exactly. Exactly. And sometimes they came and they stuck around for a while, like She's the One after Badlands and before Mary's Place. That one stuck around for a long time, I think, for the rest of the tour. I think it alternated with Out in the Street a little bit. And then sometimes it just, they would come and go like I'm a Rocker. It didn't exactly stick around very long, but made a couple of memorable appearances, including, I guess, courtesy of our friend Jason.
Yeah, but we'll get to that one in a moment.
That's a couple months later. Sorry. Yeah.
So Kansas City, 5 tour premieres, Night, Something in the Night, She's the One, Incident, and then the closing. I believe that's the first song after Land of Hope and Dreams, People Get Ready, right?
Yes, it was.
They did a cover of Kansas City, of course, topical for the location.
Yes, that's one thing he would do. And I think we really need to talk about Incident here, not just because Incident's a great song, but it was the first solo piano slot. It was done in a solo piano arrangement. And that was a slot that really became popular with us, because he would do For You. He did The Promise, Tougher Than the Rest, Lost in the Flood. He did a lot of songs solo piano, which it was a nod to us, to people who would see multiple shows and follow him around from city to city.
Yeah, that was something that people really looked forward to, because not only was it variety, but he was taking these songs. Now, we had seen Incident at the 2001 Christmas shows open where it was solo piano, but this was something that most people in the fan base had not seen, if ever, for a very long time.
And obviously, I think because of the popularity of the Main Point recording from February 5th, 75, it opened that show, and I think everybody wanted to hear it. I think there was definitely an aura about it, basically caused by that one show. And to hear it 27 years later, I think a lot of people were just, I mean, couldn't believe it, and they were just ecstatic about it.
Then from there, they went to Chicago. I believe this was the first Eddie Vedder guest appearance. Eddie guested on My Hometown, which followed Dancing in the Dark in the encores. There was
That's quite a swing. Dancing in the Dark, My Hometown, Ramrod.
Well, when you're bringing out one of the local heroes, I guess it works.
Now, one thing I want to say about this guest performance is that he brings Eddie Vedder out for My Hometown. I know it's his hometown. I know he grew up in Chicago and all that, but it took him until the next year to really utilize some of his guests on stage. I think they did Emmylou Harris. She did My Hometown in Birmingham, Alabama. But then the next year when she came out at Giant Stadium, it was Across the Border. Now, tell me which one was more interesting to you.
I'm going to hazard a guess here, though, that Eddie may have been involved in that selection. It makes total sense. We know that he's a fan of a lot of the Springsteen catalog, so they could have gone any number of ways, but I can't be critical of that. Eddie Vedder on stage with Bruce, that makes me happy.
Right. I'm just thinking of 2 years later when they blew our minds with Vedder Man.
That was a whole separate issue. As Eddie said, he took the E Street Band out for a little test drive there.
That was an amazing performance. And Chicago also had the solo piano For You, so he was really getting into it at that point.
And Jackson Cage made its first appearance on the tour proper. It had been played, of course, at Asbury.
And then moving on to Milwaukee, No Surrender made its tour debut. And, of course, that's every nighter, or became a very frequent visitor in the set list for the next 21 years. And a solo version of Mary Queen of Arkansas. This time it was on guitar and harmonica. So he was digging deeper than I even remembered, actually, in that solo spot.
And then, of course, the show ended with Little Queenie, which is a callback to the Bomb Scare show, the famous show where they were, can we say this? They were a little drunk.
They were loose. Are you loose out there?
It cracks me up. And again, this is not about 2023, but there is such a juxtaposition, because he was playing a very serious show with an album off of very serious events, as we all know. And yet he could find ways to be loose. That is the magic. And of course, how old was he here? He was 53. He had just turned 53 that week, actually. And he was at the top of his game throughout the Rising Tour. That's just, except for maybe opening night. But this was a tour that I think, because of the problems with the archives, it's probably a little underrated and lost by now, because they haven't been able to release the shows and give everyone a view of the type of performance that we've gotten from all the other tours. The Magic Tour, just think of the collective impact of the Magic Tour releases. I think that has really heightened what people think of the Magic Tour.
I do think that anybody who got into them after the Rising Tour, they may, because of the lack of releases, they may not give this tour as much much props as it deserves. I think you and I love this tour. We give the edge to the reunion tour, but just by a nose over the Rising Tour. And it's so disappointing that they can't access anything, as we repeat ourselves for the 60th time. But if there was any way just to release something on just two track or just something, especially from something from September of 2002 or even September of 2003, I think people would really understand how excited we were at the time.
Yeah, this tour deserves to be heard, but we've said that so many times. And as we know, I'm sure they would love to pull it off, but they just can't seem to be able to figure it out. So I guess there's no point in just going over it again and again, but it's so frustrating.
Very, very. And then they moved on to Fargo, North Dakota, which they actually had played in 99. So it wasn't totally a surprise. And that's where Working on the Highway made his tour debut, which, not exactly a headliner after the reunion tour, but it was different. It had kind of a country violin jam thing going on in the middle, which I was just reminded of by Bruce Bass. And it was a lot of fun. It was absolutely a lot of fun. The version from Boston of that song was just tremendous.
Then they moved on to St. Paul, which I'm actually looking at Bruce Bass. I never knew this. Did you know this? Restless Nights was soundchecked in September of 2002.
I did know that. I haven't heard it. I mean, I don't know if any of our IEM taper friends were there, but I haven't heard it. But the
that highlights must have been big.
Well, I don't know. Obviously, it wasn't good enough to be played because it wasn't played for another 7 years. And that was the only time it's been played ever. But that night did get further on up the road and Nothing Man in their tour debuts, which were pretty big at the time.
Yeah, those are two welcome debuts as he was working his way through the Rising material. Of course, Further on Up the Road had been played first in Atlanta and then at the Garden at the tail end of the reunion tour. But this is a really solid show in and of itself. You know, a single city where he probably wasn't going to return, and they got a very, very compelling show on the Rising Tour. So it just, I think that what he was doing here was he wanted to make each show a little distinct. There was no reason that Further on Up the Road or Nothing Man had to be played there, except that was what he wanted to do on that night.
And other highlights from the show include Racing in the Street and another post Land of Hope and Dreams song, Working on the Highway. Again, not one that would have made our headlines, but still fun and notable for just for the fact that it's done at the end of the show.
And now we're returning to the Northeast, and he's coming through the home stretch of this leg, and we're going to take a break. We'll pick back up next time with the European leg. But he went to Boston. This was the first time ever that Dirty Water was played with Peter Wolf. It was 3 hours, the longest show of the tour so far. And he dedicated My Hometown to Lenny Zakum, who had passed away a couple of years prior.
And earlier in the day, Bruce also appeared at a dedication for a bridge named after Lenny Zakum, and he played Thunder Road. And of course, the big weekend continued the next night when he played Saturday Night Live, and that was when he did that amazing version of You're Missing.
That was stunning. When you think of going on live TV and he wants to showcase the record, of course, the first song they did was Lonesome Day, which was true to the tour arrangement. But You're Missing, out of nowhere, he sits down at the piano and does this devastating take on the song. It was really kind of mind-boggling, and in a way, it was a shame that the song was never played that way again, except for the one time, I think, a few years later on the Devils and Dust tour, the only time it was played on that tour, right?
In Buffalo, yes.
Yeah. So, but the sense of longing and loss and the way he sang the song, especially considering, again, it was on national TV. Like, if he had done that in a theater show somewhere, you would have gone, okay, that I understand for that kind of venue. But on national TV, what he delivered there was, look, that's when we talk about Bruce and the way he's able to deliver on certain specific moments, to me, the You're Missing on Saturday Night Live is right up there with just about any of them.
Exactly. It was just so powerful, as you said. And looking at it from another perspective, here he is. This is his first time on Saturday Night Live. And, right? I mean, I'm not misremembering.
You're not counting 92?
Oh, okay. All right. So, and this is first performance with the E Street Band on Saturday Night Live. I knew I was forgetting something. They come out, they do Lonesome Day, and then the next time it's Bruce solo. So you would imagine that they would have come out and rocked it, like kind of like they did later on like in 2015 or 2020.
It was 20.
My God, my memory's going.
When we were locked in our homes, so I know yes. It's hard to remember.
Yes. Well, all the years kind of run together sometimes. But this time he just sat down and played that thing solo. And man, that took cojones. And I know he's got him, and I know he knows he has him. And he really delivered on that one.
Yeah, that was truly amazing. And just in those circumstances, it really just takes your breath away. And that's, again, that's why he is who he is, because there are very, very few performers who would have done that.
Yes. And he pulled it off well. And then the next night,
you were there, right?
I was in Philadelphia. I went up, and that was a hell of a show, too. I know we keep saying that, but damn, this run of shows was spectacular. The first big surprise was when he pulled that Bus Stop. That was the tour debut. And I think, how many times did he do that on the reunion tour? Just that one time also in Philly?
No, he did it a couple of other times. I know it was played at the Garden.
Yes, you're right. He did at the Garden. But he did Bus Stop. He did For You. Actually, I believe was full band. And then he pulled out Streets of Philadelphia. Not a surprise, I know, considering the city he was in. But it was solo piano, but he brought up Lisa Lowell and I think Susie and Patty contributing backing vocals, which made that one actually my favorite performance of that song basically ever. And then he followed it up with a solo piano incident. So he was really hitting all the high marks for me at this one.
And I remember the Kitties Back that ended that show. I wasn't there, but I remember listening to it. It sounded like the crowd was going so bonkers.
Yes, they were. That was the first time it had been done at a regular E Street show since 78. And so, yeah, people were losing their shit, to say the least. Even I was enjoying it. And it was a hell of a show. I remember getting a recording of that one, a good one, and just blasting the hell out of it while driving around at the time.
And the Promised Land was not played in this show. Again, pointing out that in the past, certain songs, no matter how regular they were subject to be dropped from shows. There was nothing except really Born to Run that was untouchable.
Well, what's interesting about that, and I was going to say this at some point, was that slot, the post waiting slot, became a wild card spot. It wasn't always Promised Land as 2002 wore on, and certainly throughout 2003. And at this one, you got Bus Stop and For You, a double shot of greetings. And then at the next show the next show in Buffalo, he did You Can Look and No Surrender there. So again, he dropped an old war horse, and he brought something like a rotating slot that you never know what was going to appear there.
Yeah, and is it safe to say that if they could access the tapes, that this show from October 6, 2002 would make a good archive release?
It definitely would. It would be on my short list, that is for sure, especially from 2002. But I also have a very soft spot in my heart for Buffalo, and I wasn't even there. But the fact they did Tougher Than the Rest, that was the first time any Tunnel song was done on the tour. And then a solo piano Lost in the Flood was, that's a hell of a double shot right there. If what do you think?
Yeah, he was staying true to the foundation of the show, but within that, he was bringing in a lot of interesting material, Tougher Than the Rest, followed by a solo piano version of Lost in the Flood. You did also get the You Can Look in there. But I just think there were some other interesting changes to the show. It went The Rising, Lonesome Day, Darkness on the Edge of Town, Further on Up the Road. So the opening of this show is quite a bit different in feel than some of the other shows.
Well, by this time, he had dropped the fuse. It was no longer an every nighter. And even in Philadelphia the previous night, he only did four shows, four songs, four rockers to start the show. And he did it again in Buffalo. And yeah, you're right. To end that four-song set with Further was definitely a different feel than ending it with the fuse Into Darkness.
Let me point something else out to you as I'm looking at it. The first seven songs of the show, six of them off The Rising and then Darkness. This was the type of thing, again, it takes balls to do this. He's in an arena. Now, of course, The Rising was an extremely well-received album, but still, you just didn't see that from a lot of artists, and he did it. I think there's something we're leaving unsaid there, but we'll move on.
But yeah, but you're right. He had a lot of faith in that material. He came out six, as you're right, six out of the first seven songs. And then he does two, he does You Can Look and No Surrender. Then he goes into another new song, Worlds Apart. And then he gets into Badland, She's the One. And then two more new songs in Mary's Place and Counting on a Miracle. So he was really drawing heavily on the new album. And it was more than holding its own on at these shows on this tour.
Yeah, crowds were totally into these shows. This was not a case where he was playing new material and people were walking out or anything like that. That
no.
did not go on.
No, not at all. People were into the show. Sunny Day, that was people got into it from the get-go. I think even we were, as I said earlier, without any kind of kid karaoke coming on stage, he was kind of keeping it, basically letting the crowd do all the singing. And it was a lot of fun. I really actually look forward to it on this part of the tour.
Yeah, he had such command at that point. Just everything that he did on the stage. And obviously that's why we went to so many shows. And that's why he's considered one of the greatest live performers, if not the greatest live performer of all time. So with this Buffalo show, should we break here at the official end of the first leg of the Rising Tour? And we'll pick back up with Europe in the next episode. Because there were also some really great shows in Europe.
Sounds good to me. And there were, and talk about the Live in Barcelona release. And there were so many excellent bootlegs to come out of Europe, courtesy of Crystal Cat, and they really captured the tour really well.
Yeah, they did, and that's very fortunate, the as we know did. Under the
bootlegs
circumstances.
Did. Not yeah. Bruce Incorporated, just the bootleggers.
All right, we're done. We'll come back next time. We're going to continue with part two. We'll also hopefully have coverage of the tour continuing, and with that, I'll just wrap things up. None But the Brave is a presentation of Evergreen Podcasts, produced by Bull Market Entertainment. On the web, you can find us at nbtbpodcast.com. And on Twitter, we're at nbtbpodcast.
So for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flynn McClain saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of The Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.